Good health is a crown worn by the healthy that only the ill can see. Your health really is your wealth. Join us for the next hour as we explore disease and attaining and maintaining good health. This is Dis-Chem Medical Monday, brought to you by Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
And we are live. It's the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show here on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm your host, Nicholas Ingle, and today we're going to be chatting with Dr. Ronwin van Eerben, and we're going to be talking cancer. Dr. van Eerben is a medical oncologist. Let us have your questions for our guest on our studio WhatsApp number 061-895-1019, and we'll get the doc to answer them for you.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
It's a little bit of a nippy day here in Johannesburg. Thank you for joining us. We're going to bring in some warm conversation, and I'm going to be joined now by Dr. Ronwin van Eerben. Doc, did I get the pronunciation of your first name correct?
Ronwin, yes, that's all
good. Ronwin, thank you. Excellent, thank you. Whew, it's a lot of pressure, Doc. So thank you for joining us. Welcome to the show. It's absolutely wonderful to have you here. I think a very, very important topic. I don't know of a family in South Africa, perhaps worldwide, that hasn't been touched by cancer. And I think just for our listeners, let's touch on actually what is cancer. Let's take it right back to a very basic level. You know, maybe start it like, what is cancer? What is a cancer cell versus a normal cell, and so on? So it's yours, Doc, the floor.
Thanks so much. So always I say that our body is very finely tuned and well regulated by many processes that causes our cells to grow and die on a daily basis. And what happens in the normal body is that there are many pathways that regulate growth of cancer cells. And these pathways are regulated by genes called oncogenes or tumor suppressor genes. And essentially what an oncogene is, if you look at it the same way as a brake or an accelerator in a car, is that your oncogene is your accelerator that causes cell growth. And your tumor suppressor gene causes breaks, so it causes the cell to stop growing. And if one of these is dysregulated, then you get overgrowth of cells because it's growing too fast, or we get that the cells are not breaking and stopping or causing normal cell death. And for that reason, we then develop a cancer. And our reasons for this is many, many different reasons. So basically, lifestyle, hereditary causes, exposure to certain toxins, those sort of things. And a lot of the times we actually can't say why this dysregulation happens or what the reason for it is. And yeah, sometimes it just goes wrong.
Okay. If we look at sort of the dysregulation, from my understanding, then cancer is uncontrolled growth of the cells. Okay. Are there situations where, or do we see this in the world, where you can be exposed to certain chemicals, have certain lifestyle habits and trends, and not get cancer, where on the other side, even if you're looking after yourself, there's the potential to develop cancer because these cells are not, they're not behaving?
Yeah, I think the irony about cancer is that it doesn't have a specific local person that it chooses. And some of my patients will be really, really healthy individuals that eat correctly, exercise regularly. Some of them are comrades runners and they still develop cancer anyway. But obviously, there are many things that do increase the risk of cancer, and that would be specifically lifestyle things like smoking, alcohol, eating incorrect food, mainly processed food, not having, living a good, healthy lifestyle as well.
If we take it down into the cell, and we're looking at the actual mechanics that are happening within the cell. Normal growth is normal growth. When does it become a risk to the cell? And then when does it become cancerous? And what does that cancer actually do within the body and to the body? There's sort of three questions there.
So basically what happens that you, depending on which area in the body it is, usually what happens, it starts with the underlying cells undergoing something we call dysplastic or abnormal changes. And these basically with time become more and more unusual, grow more abnormally or more rapidly or more disorganized. And then those dysplastic cells and society changes in the cell then eventually become more disorganized and grow into a tumor. The right. type of cancer that you have will depend on where it develops in the body. So we basically, divide cancers into two broad groups. It'd be hematological cancers, which are blood cancers, and then solid tumors, which are cancers that start from one of the solid organs in the body. The solid cancers are divided into two main groups. So we get something called carcinomas, which are like from different cell types. So it would be like your breast or your colon or your gut or your lungs. And then other cancer types that are called sarcomas, that will basically start more in like muscle or connective tissue or cartilage or tendon. So those are the broad groups of where the abnormalities will occur and how cancers will develop.
Okay. And is there a different level of risk depending on where the cancer is developing in the body?
So I think that the risk of the cancer would depend on how disorganized or how aggressive the cells are growing. So for different cancer types, you can have low-grade cancers or cancers that don't grow very rapidly or disorganized. So we call those like our indolent or slow-growing cancers. And we also get cancers that are maybe an intermediate grade or a moderately differentiated grade, which is like kind of slow but not too fast. And then we also have very rapid-growing or like grade 3 cancers, which can develop or grow quite quickly. So I think that would be specific to the patient, the cancer type, and what we're seeing after we send the tissue off for histology and what the pathologist tells us that they can see after looking at it and deciding, you know, what's happening in that specific. Okay.
How big a component to this is genetics? Not to make light of it, but, you know, it's a wonderful movie came out many years ago called Brighton Beach Memoirs. And the protagonist was talking about, you know, every time he sneezes, he thinks it's cancer. And so that's prevalent in our community where we really, you know, oh, I've got a bump on my skin. It must be. So how prevalent is genetics? So if someone in your family does have cancer, is it something that you need to be taking super care of, and are there tests that you can be doing?
So I didn't watch that movie, but I'll get this. Okay. It's just
what you asked.
So I think the thing is that obviously hereditary causes does increase your risk for cancer. So yes, we do say to patients with certain types of cancers, not all types, that if you have a family member, so usually a first degree relative that has a cancer, that you are at a higher risk for it. This is more likely for specific types of cancers like breast cancers or prostate cancers, for instance. But it doesn't mean just because someone in your family has a cancer that you automatically are high risk. So usually how we determine those risks is that we use, if we have a patient that's been diagnosed with the cancer and they have a lot of history or different family members that have also have had a diagnosis of cancer previously, then in that instance, we usually work with genetic counselors that, go through the whole history of your family, the different types of cancers that different members of the family have had. And then what they do is they kind of do a genogram, or they kind of look at what the risks is, and then they decide if it's necessary to actually test for hereditary types of cancers and which are the correct ways to go about that. And importantly, also what comes in with that is, because people do get very fearful or very anxious about it, is that they also help to counsel the patient as well as their family members, that what that means for them. So what does it mean in terms of risk for their children, their brothers, their sisters, and what it means in terms of screening them for other types of cancers that you might be at risk for. So Yeah, the bottom line is that just because you have a family member doesn't mean you are at risk. There's a whole process that we go through to determine that, and certain types of counselling and testing that we do as well.
Fantastic. We're heading towards ad break, and when I come back, I want to touch on sort of the development around the treatment of cancer, the community, and so on, in terms of now and let's say 30 years ago. So we'll touch on that as soon as we're back from these words from our sponsors. My name is Nicholas Ingle. You are listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday Show here on 101.9 High FM.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
And Dr. Ronwen van Eeden has joined us here on the Dis-Chem Medical Monday Show on 101.9 High FM. My name is Nicholas Ingle, and I'm chatting with the doc about cancer and just unpacking what it is, getting an understanding on it. And now I'd like to sort of look at the support structure. How much have things changed over the last 2 to 3 decades in terms of awareness, treatment, early prevention, and so on, Doc?
So I think there's been a huge explosion in terms of the cancer field, particularly in terms of screening programs that have been implemented for high-risk individuals. I think the goal really of cancer management and cancer treatment is to diagnose it in its early stages. So screening is really important. The other thing we've had a big change is obviously in the treatment and the management of cancers. And I mean, over the past 10 years, even just there's been such a huge change in how we approach therapies and more importantly, the different types of therapies we have. So historically, patients that usually had quite dismal cancers or cancers with poor prognosis didn't have a lot of options in terms of choices of treatments. And we mainly only had chemotherapy and radiotherapy and historically as the management. So now because we, and going back to the first thing we spoke about, the different cancer pathways, because now we have such huge broad knowledge of these pathways and where each of the abnormalities occur within specific cancers, how medicine or how oncology has moved is more towards what we call now precision oncology, meaning that for each patient, we can individualize treatment. We can take the tumor types. We can do something called molecular-based testing. We can do sequencing. We work on a lot on types of therapies that are directed by something we call biomarkers. And biomarkers would basically be what the tumor tells us about how it behaves and what specifically are its different mutation and targets that we can, find a specific therapy for. So now what we're looking at is obviously not just using chemotherapies anymore, but using different types of therapies, mainly therapies called immunotherapies that harness the body's immune system to fight cancer. And then also targeted therapies that look at the specific abnormality or mutations within the patient's cancer, so we can target that specific mutation or abnormality. And just like that has really, really evolved. And what we're seeing now is patients that had very difficult or horrible to treat cancers before are now having better outcomes. They're living longer. And more so also, they're having better quality of lives on their treatments because the treatments are more specific and not so broad in terms of side effects and toxicities.
Thank you so much, Doc. We're answering the questions that we have, but let us have your questions on our WhatsApp number 061-895-1019 here on the Dis-Chem Medical Monday Show on 101.9 High FM. I'm Nicholas Ingle, chatting with Dr. Ronwen van Eeden. Doc, what are some of the, and I always have to be careful when I say this because sometimes common sense isn't so common. What are some of the common sense things that we can be doing in our lives to reduce our possibility of developing cancer?
So the common sense things is obviously don't do things to your body that can damage it or that is toxic to it. So things that are harmful chemicals like smoking, vaping,
Sure.
also obviously anything that's excessive. So excessive alcohol. Also the other important thing that we see is that obesity and not controlling our weight or leading sedentary lifestyles has also got a big impact. There's a lot of research that goes with exercise and cancer, and how important to keep moving, to do regular exercise is to decrease our risk of cancers, but also in patients that have previously had cancers to increase their outcomes, decrease their risk of recurrence. So those are the kind of obvious things, so that you can do to help yourself.
So eat like an adult, basically.
Yes. Like a healthy
Live like
adult.
an adult, a healthy adult. I suppose
Yes.
it's always, if you wouldn't feed it to a 6-month-old, why would you eat it? That's
Yeah.
sort of the
Yeah, and I
the
think patients have a lot of questions around what are the right things and the wrong things to eat. I think there's a lot of myths and also like things out on the internet that mislead people. So I always say anything that's excessive is always bad for you. So it's important to get a good balance of protein, fiber, fruits, veggies, your nutrients, and it's not the end of the world if you have a drink now and then, or maybe a chockey now and then, but that's fine. But anything that's too much is is bad for your body. So that's the general rule of looking after yourself.
I suppose going to the chocolate thing, because you saw I was smiling there.
Yes.
Look at quality rather, rather than eating chocolate frequently, try and get a better quality product, perhaps. Touching on the sugar, how bad is sugar? Because we've heard online and in the press that, sugar is rocket fuel for cancer. Even so, long processed meats are 100% carcinogenic. And there's a lot of sort of stories out there. And how true are they? I suppose to an extent. But is it just at the end of the day, it comes down to how we started this segment, just, moderation and eat responsibly.
Yeah, so I think the thing is about excess, like things in excess. Excessive sugar causes you to pick up weight. It causes obesity. It causes chronic inflammation, which is the basis of cancer and your body not being healthy and being dysregulated. So I think that the main thing there is that also patients that are overweight, that don't move around a lot, those are the patients that have inflammation and that are at higher risk. So the sugar doesn't directly give you the cancer. So if you eat it, it's not as if it goes into your body and feeds a cancer cell. What happens is when you keep eating sugar over and over, start picking up weight, don't look after yourself, and that's basically how your cancer develops.
Right. I suppose it's simple that anyone who values exercise and movement and eating well is not going to be eating lots of sugar because they don't want to deal with the spikes in the blood sugar and the crashes. You're not going to eat a 120 gram slab of chocolate and go for a walk because you might be in
Well,
trouble.
I think that's the thing. I think all healthy habits lead to an overall healthy lifestyle. So if you are exercising regularly, drinking lots of water, looking after yourself, then you're not going to want to eat the bad things or do things that can hamper that because you're looking over at your overall well-being. And then I think it's just a mindset. I think that the main thing is that I always say to patients that anything is better than nothing. And the more you start eating healthy, the more you start exercising, you feel better about yourself, you feel stronger, you feel healthy. And then that becomes into a healthy cycle then where you want to do more good things and more healthy things. Regarding exercise, we always say the best, when you want to quantify it, I say if you're doing do anything, but the good amount is 150 minutes a week of mixed different exercises, cardio, strength exercises, and that creates an overall healthy, like well patient.
Fantastic. If we look at now the different types of cancers, sorry, the different stages, excuse me.
Yes.
What are the different stages of cancer? And I suppose it's a little bit of a difficult question to ask, and I want to be careful, but is there a stage that's too late?
So, I mean, obviously, your best chance or your best outcome is going to be if you're diagnosed early or in an early stage. Different stages have different staging protocols, or we stage them in different ways. But overall, most cancers or solid tumors are staged by something called a TNM staging, where we look at the tumor size, whether there's regional lymph nodes involved, and then also whether or not it's spread to other places. I think the way cancer treatments are evolved is actually that even patients that sometimes have stage four disease or disease that has spread from the primary site into another place in the body or another organ, that depending on the magnitude of the spread, the size of the spread, how many lesions or how many like spots we see on the scans, sometimes even in advanced disease, if it's managed well, it can be converted into disease. We call it no evidence of disease. So it really, really, really depends on the patient, the type of cancer they have, what's in, how many organs are involved, how many spots are involved, and then we can manage that from a holistic point of view, like with a multidisciplinary team using different methods or different treatment modalities to manage the cancer. I would say that where something is too late is where patients have left things for very long. So as if I think a lot of people have an element of fear, so they'll see a lump maybe in their breast and kind of brush it off as something else, and then it becomes really, really big, or it spreads, and then it gets difficult to manage because then we're just controlling things and managing things and kind of trying to keep it from spreading more or getting out of control. So I wouldn't really say there's ever a point that's too late, unless there's a patient that comes in and maybe they're so sick and they're so weak by that point. And then when we don't have a relatively strong patient, then then it kind of gets difficult to give them any type of treatment. So the message here then would be that don't ignore symptoms that are persistent, don't ignore lumps, don't leave things for long, because usually if you act on something quickly or early, or rather get it checked out, then that's going to be the time where we can manage things in the best way and get it under control.
And get it under control as quickly as possible. And that's why I asked you a little bit earlier in our chat about sort of how different is the world now for a potential cancer patient versus a decade or two or three ago, in terms of support groups and treatment and so on. Because I think a lot of people still in this day and age are scared, and we prefer to sweep things under the rug. And my understanding is that women particularly live longer than men because they seek medical treatment sooner, perhaps. So guys, we just kind of sweep it and leave it on its own. How valuable is quick diagnosis? And if someone is diagnosed with cancer, what are the support structures available to help them, from community to groups and so on?
So I mean, the biggest value I think probably would be just for patients to have regular checkups and so we can pick up things early. I think it depends on your support and your structures and your availability of care. I think obviously it depends on where you are in the country or what you have access to. I think obviously our country is quite a broad range of different population groups and socioeconomic groups. So really, I think that in terms of support, like still a large part of our population, like 80%, is served by the public sector. And then obviously there, it's always a little bit harder to get access to care. We have to realize that there's those group of patients, and then obviously the smaller part of the population which has access to private health care. And so I think depending on where you are in the country, where you are, your communities, your social circumstances, your religious backgrounds, your cultural backgrounds, so that would be mostly dependent on the type of support structures that you have in place.
That's available. Okay. I stand cor under correction, but with cancer, with the different stages, it's stage 1 through 4. And what are each of the different stages?
So you you mean?
Is that quite a broad question?
Let me throw this one out.
Yeah, okay. Or what is the reason that we have cancer rated in different stages?
So I think the main thing is that your early stages, so your stage one, your stage two cancers, that's where we're looking at mostly curable stages. So those are the stages also that usually require maybe sometimes less intervention or less amounts of treatments. Then when you get to stage three cancers, then those are more advanced. Those usually require like more intensive treatments, and then they also have a higher risk for recurrence and relapse. And obviously stage four cancers, then those are cancers that have spread already. Those are the cancers then that are not curable, but in most instances manageable. So we manage the disease, we manage the symptoms, much like any other chronic condition, like diabetes or heart disease or anything like that. It's not something that's going to go away, but you'll always require some sort of management or treatment. So in a nutshell, the different stages are the earlier you diagnose, the earlier stage, the more likely you are to be cured, and you want to be at that stage, which is why you must screen, which is why you must check out something if it's not right. And then obviously the later stages are, the more high risk they are, or the more difficult they get, a bit harder to manage, if I can put in that way.
Okay, got it. So that's perfect. That answers the question, because it comes down, my understanding is then it's just the more progressed the disease is, the further down the stages you go, and the later, you know, perhaps that there's diagnosis, if I'm understanding that correctly.
Yeah, I think the main thing is always just I think that people must always have an open and honest conversation with the oncologist or the doctor that's treating them. I think, you know, what is different also about medicine these days is that it's not old school where you come to the doctor, they tell you what to do, they tell you what's happening. It's just that patients have such a wealth of information at their fingertips. They've got AI, they've got Google, they've got everything. So a lot of the times they come to you kind of already knowing like what's happening, and sometimes even with their own treatment plan in place and everything available. So I think it's important to be able to, you know, yes, do your own research so you're informed, but also like to have good open discussions with the oncologist or the doctor that's looking after you, so that you're both on the same page, you understand where your diagnosis is, where your stage is, what can or can't be done. Also, you know, to still kind of take guidance from the doctor or the oncologist that's looking after you, but, you know, in conjunction with different things and health style, lifestyle management and everything like that.
100%. We're going to go to ads now, Doc, and then when we're back, I'd like to chat a little bit deeper about the genetic issues, particularly with regards to prostate cancer and breast cancer that we touched on a little bit earlier. I'm chatting with Dr. Ronwin van Eerden, medical oncologist, and you are listening to the Dischem Medical Monday Show here on 101.9 Chai FM. My name is Nicholas Ingle. Let us have your questions for the doctor on 061-895-1019.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dischem. Better health starts here.
Thank you so much for joining us here today on the Dischem Medical Monday Show on 101.9 Chai FM. My name is Nicholas Ingle, and I'm chatting with Dr. Ronwin van Eerden, medical oncologist. Doc, just before we went to the break, I wanted to sort of touch on again the genetic components around prostate cancer and breast cancer. Those two particular cancers seem to be the most common that we encounter when we're talking to people. Can we touch on each of those a little bit more in depth? And if you have any questions for the doctor, let us have them on our WhatsApp number, 061-895-1019. Sorry, Doc, I'm still fighting a bit of a tummy bug, so cognitive function's a little bit lower than normal.
All right. So breast cancers are obviously the most common diagnosed cancer in women and prostate in men, and that's why we see them or come across them so frequently when we're talking to people. Other common cancers are things like colorectal cancer, so that's also important, and then obviously cervix cancer in women as well. And I think the important things about these cancers is that all of these are cancers that can be screened for. So you can have mammograms with your breast cancers, pap smears, checks with your PSA or your urologist, and also colorectal cancers, you know, from, I think the guidelines is from the age of 50, but I think as early as 40, you can start considering going for colonoscopies or gastroscopies, depending on your risk factors. So in terms of specifically hereditary cancers, breast cancer, hereditary causes in women, there are certain populations that are higher risk for hereditary cancers, such as Jewish population, and in South Africa, also the Afrikaner population. Mm-hmm. And the most common genetic cause that people are familiar with, obviously, is the BRCA mutation. And I always say that was made famous by Angelina Jolie when she first tested for it and had prophylactic mastectomies or had a breast removed, to risk reduce. BRCA mutations are, we have different types, BRCA1 and BRCA2. And then each of those are associated with different types of breast cancers that you can get, and then also other types of breast cancers. It's important to remember that BRCA is not the only hereditary cause for breast cancer. There are also other hereditary mutations, such as CHEK mutations or ATM mutations that can also occur in certain populations but are more infrequent and the risk is not as high. BRCA mutations, for instance, are if you are diagnosed with one, then usually your risk of developing breast cancer is as high as 80 to 90%. In your general population, is about 12% if you're a woman and just have breasts. So it does significantly increase your risk. And also what that helps us with is the discussion also around other types of cancers that you then are at high risk for if you carry one of those genes. So, for instance, BRCA1 is associated with ovarian cancer as well. So in certain women, we would also recommend or, consider having prophylactic oophorectomies, which means removing the ovaries to decrease the risk of ovarian cancer. And then BRCA2, for instance, would be more associated with other cancers like stomach or pancreatic or prostate cancer. So, genetics goes into quite a broad thing and quite a wide, different types of genes and pathways. I think that the main thing is that if you do have a family history, then obviously to make sure that you're screening regularly for those types of cancers. And like I said earlier, we don't just randomly test people for genes or hereditary causes, because like I said, there's a big consideration or impact that goes with that, like what type of anxiety that will give the patient in terms of, being afraid of everything being cancer that's wrong with them, and also for their families and those kind of things.
So it's just really about being a little bit responsible, building a relationship with a medical practitioner. Would this be, if there is a family history, would you be going to see an oncologist or a GP, just from a practical point of view?
So yeah, you'd only see an oncologist once you have an actual diagnosis of cancer. So usually we don't manage screening or general checks or those kind of things. So I think it's important for if you do have a family history that you work closely in conjunction with your general practitioner, and then obviously to help you maybe have a pathway in terms of what your screening looks like. So from the age of 40 for women, definitely to do yearly or every second year a mammogram, and then obviously also to do regular pap smears, So those are the two important things for us as well. And then, you know, I think it's hard to say sometimes how often you should be checking for certain things. Obviously, if you smoke a lot or you're a heavy smoker, then there is some role for screening with low dose CT scans as well. So I think it's really good to work with your general practitioner, go through what your lifestyle looks like, what your risk factors are, what your family, and then kind of have a plan or a pathway that you can do where you line up for your general checks. And yeah, it's difficult because obviously there's no way to predict these things, you know, so like anything can happen at any time. So I always say, like, also just be aware and be mindful of like your body and things that change or things that are persistent or things that don't look normal, and to have those checked out.
Right. But I think it's such a relief or peace of mind knowing that you can just deal with your GP, and it's not that you're having to go and sit in a waiting room at an oncologist to have something checked, rather having this done at your GP where you have the relationship, a lot less pressure for people to have to deal with. And what the point I'm getting to is less reason not to go and get things checked. So that, you know, that's something that's so important. Just before we go to ads again, Doc, in your experience, what has the patient experience been like now in this country? Well, the clients that you are dealing with in terms of cancer diagnosis, the support that's around and available.
So obviously, by the time I see a patient, you know, they've already got a cancer diagnosis, so there's a huge level of anxiety that goes with that. In terms of managing those patients, I think it's important that, you know, the oncologist that you work with also works in a multidisciplinary unit specifically for breast cancer, and that they, you know, discuss your case and that you get like holistic management. Specifically at our rooms, what we try to do for support is that we've got obviously a dietitian, a physiotherapist, a psychologist. So basically just to have access to all those aspects of the different aspects of your well-being.
Of the support. Well, yeah. But it's a holistic approach, which is great. And yeah, wonderful to see. We're going to go to ads now. When we're back, we will wrap up and get some great, no pressure, Doc, advice to prevent cancer from the doctor. You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. It's the Disco Medical Monday Show, and my name is Nicholas Ingle.